Good morning. It's 8:06 on this Monday. You're listening to KPCW Park City. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on Local News Hour this morning. Currently, it's 31 degrees and partly cloudy in Park City, 34 and partly cloudy in Heber. With details on the upcoming forecast is ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at partly cloudy skies as we go throughout our Monday. Temperatures will climb near 60 degrees in the Park City area. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid-60s in the Heber Valley. Look for partly cloudy skies to continue into our Tuesday. We'll notice those winds starting to pick up out of the south, so it'll become breezy, if not downright windy, as we go into the afternoon with wind gusts over 30 miles per hour at times. High temperatures will climb once again near 60 degrees for Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid-60s in the Heber Valley. Now, as we move into your Tuesday night, showers and thunderstorms will become likely across the area as a cold front moves into the region. It's another potent cold front, so we'll see those winds that will continue to switch from the south to out of the north and west and still remain gusty. That will also bring in some colder air. So as we go into your Tuesday night, we'll see those temperatures dropping down into the mid to upper 30s in the Park City area and Heber Valley area as well. Again, as those temperatures drop, we could see some snowflakes mixing in with those rain showers, especially above 7,000 feet. Otherwise, as we go into your Wednesday, look for scattered rain and, yes, mountain snow showers to continue. Highs will only be in the 40s for us in Park City, with highs in the low 50s in the Heber Valley. Moving into your Thursday, we'll still stay with that northwesterly flow, which will keep a little bit of moisture in the area. So look for a chance of still scattered showers in the Heber Valley area. Temperatures will start off in the low 30s with highs in the 40s. So can't rule out a snowflake there. And looking like snow showers will be possible as we go into your Thursday for the Park City area. Again, there could be some accumulations around the Park City area for us Wednesday into Thursday as that cold air continues to work its way in. Highs will struggle to get out of the 30s as we get towards your Thursday afternoon. As we move into your Friday, we start to dry things out and winds start to switch around again. We're in the upper 40s in Park City and highs in the mid 50s in the Heber Valley with partly cloudy skies. Look for lots of sunshine this weekend. Highs in the 50s in Park City and highs in the low 60s for the Heber Valley. Let's look at your Wasatch Back forecast. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up on Local News Hour this morning, first we'll have an update from Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. He has some info to share about vaccine clinics and other things happening health-wise around the county. Next, we'll hear the latest from the Heber City Council with Councilmember Sid Ostergaard. And then to close out the hour is UDOT Region 3 spokesperson Wyatt Woolley. He has some updates to share on projects happening all around Wasatch County. That's all coming up on Local News Hour this hour. Summit County and Heber City are financial supporters of this station. Utah lawmakers passed a law to set new rules for congressional district boundaries. KPCW's Christine Weller reports an attorney says the law will let the GOP maintain an advantage over Democrats in elections.
Republican lawmakers officially advanced a new map for the state's congressional districts during a special legislative session October 6th and passed a new districting law. SB 1011 set three bias tests into law that will govern future redistricting processes. Those include a partisan bias, ensemble analysis, and median mean difference test. According to KUER, Republican Senator Brady Brammer sponsored the legislation to provide, quote, objective measures or purposes of measuring whether or not a map is unduly partisan. In promoting it to fellow lawmakers, he said Proposition 4, the 2018 voter-approved initiative to prohibit gerrymandering, asks that the best available data and scientific methods be used to make sure a map doesn't favor any political party. But David Raymond, an attorney for the Utah League of Women Voters, said the tests don't make sense for Utah.
What the legislature did in Senator Brammer's bill is cherry-pick three tests that make no sense for Utah and that actually require the legislature to pass a map that has maximum partisan advantage for Republicans.
A hearing to decide which map will be instated is set for October 23rd. Raymond and other attorneys representing plaintiffs in the case against the legislature have asked Gibson to pause the new law so its tests can't be used to select new map. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
News time now, 8:11. In the studio with me is Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Phil, good morning.
Good morning, Grace.
Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
To start out, I would love to talk about last week's Vax and Go clinics. You had them all over the county. How was the turnout?
Yeah, this is the third year running for the Vax and Go clinics, and they were wildly successful. Each year we've seen year-over-year increases in the numbers of attendees. It builds momentum. The team has done a wonderful job taking that first full week of October and the Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday making that happen. Over the course of our Camas clinic, then Colville, and then Park City, we were able to offer vaccines to over 1,000 Summit County residents, both flu and COVID, in a really quick, efficient drive-through manner. It's a great event. It's fun. It's kind of pleasant. People are generally kind. And it was really inspiring to see the support that the staff received during those events. The people driving through, we had individuals come back to provide candy for us to hand out to people, support and gifts for people. It's just really, it's a great event for the community to see how serving the public health department is and how we want to be out and about and make it as easy as possible for people to receive their seasonal vaccines.
That's great to hear. How many people does it take to put on an event like that?
A lot. Yeah. the planning events start way back in May. And when we talk about the different permitting processes and applications that need to go into the cities, it takes a minute going back to May, but I'd say between the volunteers and the staff, it's anywhere from 15 to 20 people, depending on the location. And then, of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge our partners that are engaged in this: Park City Municipal, Camas, and Colville. The mayors out in Camas and Colville and in Park City have done a wonderful job allowing us to step into their communities, occupy some of their space, and then be able to provide these vaccines. So it's really a community-wide effort. It takes a lot of individuals to pull this off, and I'm grateful for everyone involved.
Great to hear. If people miss the drive-through events, lost track of the day, where can they still get vaccinated?
Yeah, great question. Any one of our three locations, we are offering Moderna vaccines here in Summit County. We have our location out in Colville, Camas, and then, of course, our main office here in Park City out at Round Valley. And then they can always go to their primary care physician. You can visit the local pharmacies. It's really not about where you get it. It's just making sure that people get it. But I will advocate that you're not going to find better people in a more fun environment to receive a vaccine than one of the health department locations.
Good deal. Let's talk a little bit about the COVID vaccine specifically. It seems that the guidance from Centers for Disease Control and Prevention keeps changing a little bit. So what's the latest guidance on the COVID vax?
Yeah, there's a lot changing at the CDC. We just kind of hang on tight and see what happens. But currently we're operating under a model called shared clinical decision making. And I'm actually an advocate of this current policy or the framework that they're using, because what it does is it puts the power to decide what's best for the individual in the individual's court. They can make that decision based on the information that's available, or if they're a little uncertain with all the things that are going on, they can always contact the health department and speak with one of our clinicians about what it means. But right now, anyone that goes through the applies the shared clinical decision making model, and in essence what that means is they've spoken with a public health nurse, can receive a COVID-19 vaccine, and that's 6 months and up, as I guess approved by the FDA for individuals to receive those COVID vaccines. So with a visit, you will have a quick chat with one of our clinicians, and they will get you set up with the best version of the COVID vaccine for you. And then based on your individual health situation, there are two different versions of the COVID vaccine. And again, you can have that conversation with one of our talented nurses at the health department, and they can guide you in the right direction.
Good deal. It seems like a lot of people believe that you need a prescription or a pre-existing condition. What are kind of the limits on who's eligible for a vaccine, or are they gone now with this new model?
Yeah, absolutely. That's, as you mentioned, kind of the uncertainty that's coming out of these recommendations. Had you asked that 2 weeks ago, you absolutely would have needed a prescription or have an underlying health condition. With the recent approval by the CDC director of the ACIP recommendations. And I know that gets a little confusing, but really where we're at is that anyone can receive a COVID-19 vaccine that is 6 months and older. If you have a child or someone that you are the guardian of, you can use that shared clinical decision-making model and speaking with a public health clinician, and they can guide you in the right direction. And the best part about it is not only does the individual have the power and the education to make the decision that's best for them and their family, it's also covered by our insurances in these circumstances or under this this model. For us at the health department, we've worked hard to create a process that if someone is uninsured, they can still be vaccinated with COVID and flu. We just have special paperwork they need to fill out inside of the department, and our nurses can take care of them as well. So anyone that through that model wants to be vaccinated, wants to be educated and make the decision that's best for them, we can make that happen.
Okay, you anticipated my question about insurance. For folks who don't have insurance, do they need to pay out of pocket, or can you cover those vaccines?
Yeah, it's if they don't have insurance and they have the ability or the means to pay out of pocket for it, absolutely we would ask them to do that, because we do have a pot of resources that allows us to extend free vaccines for those that cannot afford it. And that pot just goes a little bit further when people are able to cover the cost of that vaccine. If they aren't, that's not a big deal. We can make it happen. And so through the process with our front desk staff, they can ask the right questions and determine which situation is best for the individual. And regardless, we never want cost to be a barrier or a deterrent for someone to be protected this coming season.
Good to know. In other seasonal virus news, it's time to get those flu shots for people who like getting flu vaccines. Who do you recommend those for? Are there populations that should be especially mindful of getting that shot every year?
Yeah, I think my recommendation would be everyone. And I know that that doesn't apply. There are circumstances where individuals cannot receive a flu shot, and that's totally understandable. But even though the flu shot's efficacy varies season to season, and it's never 100% coverage, we do know, and there's a fair amount of research that substantiates that the symptoms that you have if you do get sick with the flu are much milder for those that are vaccinated. We have plenty of flu vaccine in the community through your primary care physician, through pharmacies, through the health department. If you are interested, eligible, you want that flu vaccine, there's really no reason that someone cannot be vaccinated. There's lots of access points. And again, the cost is not a barrier for us at the health department. We can make that happen. But for those that are not able or have made the decision to not be vaccinated against the flu, that's perfectly fine. But we do encourage good hand hygiene. If you're around people that are feeling ill or sick, take special precautions to protect yourself. We don't want anybody to be sick this season. We know it's inevitable, but we can still do those things to limit the impact it has on us and our families.
Definitely. As we're heading into that cold and flu season, any other general guidance for people to stay healthy as temps drop?
Yeah, I mean, it's that time of year. It's brisk this morning. The holidays are quickly approaching. We're going to be inside more often, gathering for those holiday events. And it just goes back to good hand hygiene, covering your mouth and your nose when you sneeze. And of course, most importantly, if you do feel sick, I know we all want to be tough and we want to power through, but be sure to take some time, let yourself recover, get better, and most importantly, don't share that love with everybody in your office space or that you work with, because that's how it continues to transmit through the community, is that we just feel a little tickle in our throat or a bug and we just continue to push through. And if we can keep from or refrain from doing that and stay home and protect ourselves and those loved ones, this holiday season will be a lot brighter for everybody.
Good message. Let's talk about wastewater a little bit. It's been a few weeks now since the health department detected some measles in the Summit County wastewater. Have you had any positive tests since then?
Yeah, great point. Our last sample that was positive was back in early September, and we have not had any back-to-back positive samples. And what I mean by that is across the three locations, Snyderville Basin, East Canyon, Snyderville Basin, Silver Creek, and our Colville wastewater plants, we have not had two positive samples from any one of those three sites. We have had three samples total that have been positive, but they're not consecutive in the same site, which is a strong indication that we do not have community transmission, but that we may have individuals that are passing through that are using gas stations, other facilities that potentially are introducing the measles virus into the wastewater. We do a really good job in communicating with our wastewater treatment operators, and it allows us to understand what's present in our community and plan accordingly. It's been one of the more intriguing things that we're doing in public health right now is using wastewater to identify public health concerns. And when we look at what happened during the COVID pandemic and how that was used to help us predict surges in COVID cases and what's being done now with wastewater and measles, it's a really promising field that we're trying to wrap our head around and be more proactive in.
That's really cool. And just one more question on the measles. Could you clarify that the last of those three positive samples was about a month ago now?
Correct. Yeah, early September.
Cool. And you mentioned COVID is something else you can detect in the wastewater. Is that something you're continuing to keep an eye on? What are the levels like right now?
Yeah, we continue to monitor that as a state, those same wastewater treatment plants that were mentioned. And that is reported on our dashboard on our website. Our epidemiologist, Nancy Porter, keeps a up-to-date website that discusses all seasonal diseases and measles and talks about the wastewater there. And just as we expected, it was odd to hear of people having colds during the summer, but we saw COVID-19 in the wastewater, or an increased presence in the wastewater during those times when everybody had a little bit of a cold this summer. So it is still a strong indicator of what's going on in our community. It allows us to be more proactive, and we continue to look at ways that we can expand that to be a better proactive health department.
Okay. And I don't really know much about wastewater testing. I mean, I'm no public health expert, but does it give you a sense of, for any disease, whether it's measles or COVID or whatever else you look for, does it give you a sense of how many cases there are in the community? Does it change quite a bit?
That's still an emerging technology and science. With the measles positives, it is a very simple yes or no or presence absence. We're not able to quantify that in a way that would say we anticipate there's X amount of cases of measles in the community. With COVID, it's a little bit different. We can look at the surge, and based on the genetic material and the DNA that's present in the sample, we can have a better understanding of how many cases it might be. But when we look at the science and the way the technology is evolving, I suspect that there will be a time when we can look at measles and other public health diseases and better understand exactly what's going on in the community. But for right now, with it being such an early technology, we're very grateful for it, and we'll be using it in other ways moving forward to detect some of these seasonal diseases.
That's really interesting. Thank you for explaining. And then I guess the last thing I'm curious to talk to you about this morning, unless you have more to add, is the Halloween Health Fair that's coming up next week, it looks like. What's on the agenda?
Yeah, October 23rd in Ledges. This is a great event that is in partnership with Colville City and Mayor Marsh. It's really an opportunity to get the kids out and about in their Halloween costumes, give it a test run before the big day where they're out trick-or-treating, and bring everybody into the same room, offers COVID flu vaccines, but most importantly, just create a sense of community and have a strong showing of the resources that are available to our community. This is not geared towards any one specific population or any individual. This is simply just an opportunity to get out, kind of kick off the holiday season. For me, Halloween is the start of that. This is a pre-run for that. And from 5 to 7 at Ledges in Colville, on October 23rd, we'll have a chance to do that. There'll be candy, gifts, games, all those little trinkets that parents love to leave those events with their kids have, bags full of just stuff. But it's really a good opportunity for the staff to interact with the community and then for our community partners to share the resources that are available across Summit County.
Excellent. And costumes recommended?
Absolutely. Our staff will be dressed in costumes. The providers the partners will be dressed in costumes, and we sure hope that those kids come out as well.
Awesome. Do you have your Halloween costume ready?
Not yet, but I will definitely.
All right. That makes two of us. Well, anything else you want to talk about this morning?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to come and chat with you.
Thanks so much for coming on. We've been speaking with Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Well, Park City broke the record once again for the longest charitable shot ski. KPCW's Christine Weller reports some out-of-towners got in on the action.
Around 150 Park City Sunrise Rotary Club members and other volunteers descended on Main Street at 7:30 a.m. Saturday. Over the next 6 hours, they bolted together 583 skis, placed 1,410 shot glasses on the skis, and signed people in to take their spot. Longtime Sunrise Rotary member John Lippert said the whole process is a lot of fun. He said there are always a lot of curious onlookers from out of town wondering what's going on.
It's always say, what in the world is this? And, well, we're going to drink all at one time. And they say, really? I said, yeah, it may seem a little contrived, but it's now part of our society.
Then he explains the friendly rivalry between Park City and Breckenridge, Colorado. The two western U.S. ski towns have been battling it out for years, one-upping each other each season. Park City broke Breckenridge's 2023 record in October 2024 with more than 1,380 people. Breckenridge reclaimed the world title in December with just over 1,400 people. A couple from Oak Point, Texas, were part of the curious crowd Saturday. First-time Park City visitors Rebecca and Ryan Miller came to town for a wedding and said they weren't quite sure what the Main Street hubbub was all about.
We were walking up and he said, I wonder what this is all about. I said, watch, I bet they're trying to break the world record for the most shot skis all at once.
The pair asked to join the fun and luckily were able to snag two shot spots. Drinkers stood shoulder to shoulder along the linked skis, which stretched from near the post office to the top of Main Street and back again. Some took a swig of High West Double Rye whiskey, others had apple juice.
It's like the most serendipitous thing ever just to have stumbled upon this, and they happen to just have two extra tickets. Now Absolutely. We get to walk around and say, hey, when we were in Park City, we broke the 2025 world record for the most shot skis at once.
A Canadian ski resort claims to have broken the world's longest shot ski record in March. However, Mike Lurs, a co-founder of the shot ski event in Park City, said they are not in competition with the Mont Orford Ski Resort in Quebec, Canada. That's because Park City's Sunrise Rotary Club and the Breckenridge Mountain Rotary Club, both community nonprofits, sell tickets to the annual contest with 100% of the proceeds going to local charities.
The group in Canada did a shot ski, and they just took a ski resort, pulled people off the hill, asked them if they wanted a free shot on a shot ski, and they said they set the world record. They are not a charitable event like we are.
This year, the Park City Club raised $70,000 for local nonprofits and set the new world record for the longest charitable shot ski. Breckenridge will try to take back the world record during its Uller Fest December 18th. For those who want to plan for next year, Park City's 10th annual shot ski is October 10th, 2026. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
On the phone with us is Heber City Councilmember Sid Ostergaard. He has an update from the most recent city council meeting. Sid, good morning.
Good morning, Grace. How are you?
Not bad, thanks. How about yourself?
Not bad. It's Monday, so we'll see how the week goes.
That it is, yeah. I think it'll be a good week. Well, let's talk a little bit about Heber City government. Last week, you and your fellow council members spent several hours talking with three different firms. That's as part of a big project to redesign City Park. I'm curious, as you entered into those interviews with the different finalists, what were you looking for in a successful bid for the park?
Well, we're really excited, and the three firms that were shortlisted were awesome. Totally qualified. It was a hard decision for us as council to pick the right one. We did come up with one that kind of stood above the others, and that was Terracon. And we were looking for design firms that could help us both with actually the design, but outreach to the public, because that's going to be another key part of, making sure this city plaza is representing what the public want. So, but TerraCon had a really strong interview. They came and have done many projects like this throughout the state. And it kind of resonated with us that they're not going to be, you know, they know what they're doing. And one of the things that they had that sparked my interest was the ability to help with fundraising, going after grants. And that's huge for us as a city. We don't want to put, we want to, you know, self-fund this park and the design of it and the building of it via, you know, going after grants and making sure that we're not using taxpayer money to do this. We want to, you know, do free and clear, but give back to the community. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, and I recall that the original plans drawn up by the consultant, they were pretty expensive plans for that park. So I can imagine that some grant dollars would be attractive to the city. From your perspective, what elements do you feel like are indispensable to a successful city park where people want to gather and have events?
Well, one of the things, just remember, yeah, you mentioned the previous plan, and I want everybody to understand that's conceptual. You know, we're going to get it down to the details and make sure things are right and things within that park will help or provide places for our community to, you know, hang out and enjoy each other and enjoy the park. There's things we did. Our first phase, we did the main stage and Celebration Street, which is, yeah, it was a big success. As far as I understood, a lot of the people really enjoyed and had fun this last summer. Every Thursday we have, you know, concerts in the park. And I think it was a great success. It was just a spark, you know, for what's to come. And what's to come is, you know, the new park. Well, we call it a plaza. It's not a park. We call it a plaza. And there are certain things that we need to, you know, make sure we can fund, but, you know, bring some really good amenities that people want to be down and enjoy the plaza. So we, in the conceptual plan, there was an ice ribbon, and that's, people are, some are excited, some are not. I think it could be a good amenity. It just has to be funded and done right. And sizing's huge. You know, it doesn't have to be a big ice ribbon. It could be a smaller one and still do the same job. Another was a splash pad. A lot of times people don't understand or are concerned about that, but for the people of Heber, you know, a splash pad could bring a lot of fun during the summer and a lot of activity that, you know, families can go down there and enjoy it and participate in it. So
makes sense. And I guess that's where, to your point, the public input would be really key to making these plans a success.
Yeah, it's huge. It is. It's huge. And, you know, again, we are want to go out to the public, and I ask the public to be aware. We're going to be posting times when we're going to be doing outreach and days, and I want the public to come and respond and have their input. It's huge. It has to be, because it is. It's Heber City Plaza. Mm-hmm. And we want it for the citizens of Heber plus the Heber Valley. So
yeah. Now that you've picked a firm to do the design, what's the next step in the process?
So the next step, we're going to be in negotiations with them and come up with a contract to get them engaged. And once that's done, like I said, there's going to be a lot. The first go around is going to be a lot of public outreach. Mm-hmm. And a lot of meetings with the public and with the steering committee. So it is the, well, you have to have that to make something successful in the city. You need to reach out to the general or the citizens of Heber City.
Yeah. And certainly, I'm sure the word will be spread far and wide about those opportunities to give feedback.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about another item on last week's agenda. It was the Celebration Housing Development, and that would be upwards of 200 affordable units near the existing Wasatch High School. I'm curious, in general, are council members supportive of the plan?
Yeah. Well, we are. We're definitely, and that's one of the priorities of the council, is affordable housing for our citizens of Heber City, the essential workers. And Watts Construction, Russ Watts, came and presented it to us a while back, and now he's back in front of us and is trying to, we're trying to figure out how the city can help and how we can get this accomplished, just basically because it is, we need affordable housing. Mm-hmm. It's a priority, like I said, for the council. And it seems like this is a great place. Russ has been working with the school district, and there's a lot of talk about that they need. You know, we're getting a new high school, and we need places for our teachers to live. And they are in negotiations and talks with the school district and seeing how they can help out, which is a great thing, just for the fact that, again, we need to provide housing for, you know, teachers, police, city employees, county employees, you know, all the essential workers. And this could help out a lot.
Yeah. I noticed that the plans include an affordable hotel as well as the housing units. Does that make sense to have a hotel as well as more permanent housing?
Well, that's kind of out on the table, and we really haven't dived into that part of it. The big thing is when Russ came in front of us this last time, he just wants the first phase, which is about 150-ish residents or units. And then after that, we'll just have to work through the other parts of it, and that hotel is a part of it. It was intended, if I can remember right, was his talks with IHC and having the ability to have, you know, extended stay for some of their doctors or surgeons that come in and they're a part of the IHC. So I think that was some of the thinking that Russ had on that.
Okay, that's interesting. And I know a big concern with the project has been traffic. Are you hearing good ideas about how to mitigate the traffic that would be generated by a project of this size?
Well, the big thing is if the agreement with the school district comes to be, you know, the high school is within walking distance. So hopefully we can utilize that and take advantage of that. Yeah, traffic's always a big issue, and especially on this street, it is and will be, you know, a main artery for a lot of people to drive through Heber. We're still working through those details. Yes, there are concerns, and, you know, as council, we're always concerned about that safety of our citizens. So we're just going to have to work through it.
Yeah.
So.
In that conversation with the council last week, there was some talk of collaborating with the Wasatch County Housing Authority. Casual observers of recent meetings might observe that there's been some tension between Heber and the Housing Authority. Do you think collaboration is possible on a project like this?
Oh, 100%. And we suggested, and I sit on the housing board, we suggested Russ to go back to us as the housing board and negotiate and see how both of us, the city and the housing board, can work together on this project. Yeah, again, this is something that we could do really easily, and I think it would be a good precedence for the future.
Okay. Well, and of course, you are a Heber City representative on the Housing Authority, I think I remember. So you kind of bring that perspective from both entities.
Yeah.
Well, Sid, it looks like we're actually just about out of time. We could talk all morning about Heber, I'm sure. But anything else you want to add this morning?
No. As far as the park or the plaza, please just come out. Public, please come out and give your input. We want to be transparent on that 100%. And the firm that we chose, I think, will help us with that. They've done this throughout all over, and they understand that transparency is huge. And that's all I can say is, please come out and give us your opinions and your comments and your ideas.
Great to hear. Well, Heber City Council Member Sid Ostergaard, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Grace.
All right, have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. We've been speaking with Heber Council Member Sid Ostergaard. On the phone with us is UDOT Region 3 spokesperson Wyatt Woolley, who has some updates on projects around Wasatch County. Wyatt, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Yes.
I'd love to start by talking a little bit about a project that's actually getting underway today, US 189 widening. For listeners who might not be familiar, we're talking about that stretch of highway near Deer Creek Reservoir. Tell us a little bit about what UDOT has in mind.
Yeah. So as most people know who go between Provo and Heber up the Provo Canyon, you get two lanes, and you get two lanes going both directions until you get to about Rainbow Bay area, and then it goes into a single lane both directions around the edge of the lake. And so the goal here is to separate those into two lanes both directions, and in order to do that, we're going to have to cut up and over into the mountain and then make a signalized intersection at the connection at the top of Lake where it's SR 113 and 189 meet.
Okay. So you're really going to be carving a new road into the side of the mountain there?
Yes, we are. If you go to our website, you'll see we kind of did some renderings of what it looks like. But there's some slopes down, as most people who know drive the area. The water's pretty close down over the edge. So we're going to have to go up and over and cut into the mountain to make another road.
It's a pretty sizable project. One of the reasons is safety. Could you tell us a little bit about what are some of the safety concerns there? How many head-on collisions in particular I'm interested in? I feel like we see a decent number of pretty bad crashes along that stretch.
We do. There's no separation, as we like to put it. There's no barrier. There's no guardrail. There's no space of grass or dirt or anything between the lanes. It's just a line, a striped line. And as you're going around those turns, if anyone isn't paying attention or is distracted or whatever, you can slip into the other lane, and there's no room. You either go into the drink or you go into the wall. So it is a safety issue. We have had some incidents just within the last year. I don't have all the numbers over the years, Grace, but we've had some serious incidents and some fatalities of people going into either the reservoir or having a serious crash along that corridor. And so great, what we call separation of vehicles going both directions, that gives you some space and some ability to have some safety as you're traveling.
Hopefully that will really make a difference for some drivers along that area. It sounds like in terms of traffic impacts for drivers during construction, right now it's mostly overnight, but are we likely to see more disruptive impacts as construction progresses?
It is possible. Currently we're working at night, and I think we released the schedule the other day that they're going to be doing, if they do flagging, in other words, it goes down to you have to wait for a flagger to let you through. We're going to try to do that in the middle of the night. What they're doing right now is they're trying to find a path to put over safety barrier and things to keep any rocks or dirt from falling down to the road. So they're working on where they need to go and exactly where they're going to put it. but there is a possibility that there's going to be some delays. When we get into some serious excavation work, if it does come to the point where we have to do some blasting, then we obviously will have to stop the road for that and make sure it's safe for everyone while we do that, and then clean up the road or whatever we need to do to move on. So when it does happen, I'll be sure to let everyone know.
Okay, good deal. So we'll get a heads up about any blasting before it happens?
Absolutely.
Excellent. I think people will be glad to hear that. Well, that's something to keep an eye on overnight right now. Not quite yet, but coming soon, it sounds like, is a Heber Valley bypass decision. I'm curious what kind of factors UDOT is taking into account as it decides between the two finalists for that highway.
The major factors when ever doing a study is to meet the purpose and need of the study. The purpose and need of this study was to improve Main Street in Heber, which is US 40, to improve the traffic there for residents being able to get across and drive through on Main Street and make it a safer, better Main Street for Heber. The other goal or purpose and need of the study was to improve regional traffic. In other words, people trying to drive all the way through the valley who aren't necessarily wanting to stop in Heber, but just want to get through like the oil trucks and those traveling through. So that's the main thing that we're trying to achieve here. And so we look at all the numbers, all the modeling, we take in all the public input and from all different peoples, from residents and those traveling through and those who live up North 40, those who live in the city, those who are out in the west, northwest fields, and everyone. We put everything together and we try to figure out what's the best route.
Okay. And you've shared that part of the work that you're doing right now is meeting with property owners who could potentially be affected by the route that UDOT chooses. What do those conversations look like? I mean, does UDOT need to buy land or property from people in order to build the highway?
When it comes to it, then yes. No matter which route is chosen, there's probably going to be some, what we call it, right-of-way property that we would have to purchase, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious a little bit of what that work looks like on UDOT's end. What happens to those people? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so it depends on how impactful it is. When with the right-of-way process, we get to that point. First of all, it's not a project yet, and it's there's no funding for it yet. So we can't even address the issue head-on until we finalize which route we're taking. We get funding for the project, and then we can move forward. The only other option would be if we have willing sellers that would like to sell, we would have to work with the cities to make that a purchase, and then eventually we could move forward from there. But when we get to that process, the time to actually purchase property, we will approach people. Willing sellers will go first, and they get fair and equal or better compensation for their properties, depending on how much it is. And then same with full purchases. If it happens, then it would be a full purchase take of that property, and we would help them with whatever they want, whether they want a full buyout or whether they want another property.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting to know. And it sounds like those impacts are likely to be a few years down the road, even once you pick a route.
Yes, it is. So just so everyone knows, we do work for the Utah State Legislature. So they fund us. They give us the money and the funding for all of our projects. And every project gets a certain amount of money, and we all get put into a prioritization list. And we have a giant program for the state in which we are allowed to get those funds from. And currently we're programmed out to the year 2031. So it's unlikely for anything to happen till after that. There's always circumstances where maybe the legislature would put forth money for it. They might make it a huge priority, but that's unusual. So I don't really see anything happening until after that.
Interesting. Is it still feasible, do you think, to have this road built in time for 2034 Olympics?
Yes, I know that was one of the goals that I think Kimball Junction and then some rail project was given to UDOT as a task to make sure we could get that happen by the Olympics. And I think that's still possible. How much of it would be like completely done. I'm not sure. It is such a large project, just looking at it going all the way from the north and south of the valley and across and everything, that it's possible it would be phased. In other words, we do sections of it, or maybe parts of it would have at-grade signalized intersections and just be a two-lane road or something smaller, and then eventually we'd build out more. I'm not really sure, but it's a huge project, and the goal would be, if we got the funding, to get it ready by the Olympics.
It is a huge project. Do you have a sense of how much a project of this scale will cost?
The numbers that we currently are doing in this study put it close to about $500 million.
Wow. It's a lot of money.
For either one. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that there will be public hearings in the new year about the route. What kind of feedback are you looking for at those meetings?
We're looking for all feedback. We want to know if there's anything that we've missed, if there's anything that or we may have not dived into that we really need to look into. And so we're trying to collect as much information as we possibly can. Now, I would like to point out that no matter which route we pick, we know that there's some people that aren't going to like it and some people that may or maybe are going to love it. And though those comments may be nice, they're not very helpful to us. So if you say you don't like it, tell us exactly why. Mm-hmm. And what you think we should do, and what why exactly you don't like it, or why exactly you love it. We need as much detail as you can possibly give us. That's what we're looking for.
Good to know. And Ed, you'll be sharing news about those hearings far and wide as well?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah. Last project I wanted to ask you about this morning was on North 40. I know we haven't come to a decision quite yet about adding barriers down the middle of that highway, but it looks like you did install a new traffic light. Any word on when that will be turned on? Or maybe it is on. I haven't been down there yet this week.
No, it's not on yet. As far as I know, things are hooked up. We've had some weather, some rain. Those who remember Saturday, I was up there actually Saturday night with my family, and it just dumped. But we have to wait for it to dry out, and then we got to paint some lines on the roads, you know, the stop lines and everything. And then after we do that, they'll have to do some minor testing. I don't know if Heber Valley Electric has hooked it up yet. Either they've done it or it's scheduled to be done this week. So hopefully, if everything goes according to plan, it should be up and running by this Friday, if not next week.
Good to know. And any word on when we'll have an update on whether those North 40 barriers are going to happen or more traffic lights?
I don't have a timeline yet, but I've been told that it is progressing forward.
Okay.
So that would be barrier plus those two other signalized intersections.
Gotcha. Well, certainly a lot of transportation-related construction going on around the Heber Valley right now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's Heber Valley's growing, as everyone knows. I'm sure not everyone appreciates that, but it's here, and we're trying to keep pace with the growing needs of the traveling public.
Awesome. Well, anything else you want to add this morning, Wyatt?
No, just that we appreciate Heber Valley, and we appreciate people coming out and to our public meetings. I've gone to several in the last few weeks for trails and projects and studies, and we appreciate everyone coming out and giving us their opinion.
Good to hear. Well, we've been talking with UDOT Region 3 spokesperson Wyatt Woolley. Wyatt, thanks for joining us.
Yes.
In other transportation news, Park City will host a transportation and mobility open house so residents can learn more about projects in and around town tomorrow. Featured projects include the citywide bus stop project to improve more than 80 bus stops on Park City Transit bus routes. Senior Transportation Director Connor Campobasso says project managers with the city's Recreate 248 project will also be on hand with information.
The public can expect to see updated schedules. They can talk to us about what we are planning on doing, what we're going to be looking at further, what we're going to be analyzing.
Other featured projects at the open house will include the city's Dogs on Buses program, parking in Old Town, new pedestrian pathways, and winter bus services. There will be no formal presentation at the drop-in event. Residents can stop in anytime to the Park City Mark Party Room from 5 to 6:30 p.m. tomorrow.